Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Karen Dion, author of The Marsh King's Daughter. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, Don. It's great to be here.
Could you tell us the story of the very suspenseful Marsh King's Daughter?
Sure. The Marsh King's Daughter tells the story of Helena, who, for the first 12 years of her life, lived in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by swamp or marshland in Michigan's Upper Peninsula wilderness. And during those 12 years, she never saw another human being other than her mother and father, which on the surface might sound rather grim. But Helena loved her life. She was a little tomboy. She loved the hunting and fishing and foraging. Her father taught her everything about the marsh that she needed to know. So it was a very happy upbringing, even though it was odd. Then, through a series of dramatic circumstances, she finds out at the age of 12 the reason her family lives like that is because her father kidnapped her mother when her mother was a teenager, and Helena was born in that captivity. So they leave the marsh, and I'm not giving too much away because almost all of this is on the first page of the book. That's half the story. In the other half of the story, Helena is a young mother of two little girls. She still lives in the Upper Peninsula, but her husband doesn't know her history. She's put all of the notoriety behind her. She was known even then as the Marsh King's daughter. Her father was dubbed the Marsh King by the newspapers because after the ogre in the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. So she's made a new life for herself. Her husband doesn't know anything about that, and her father escapes from the maximum security prison not 30 miles from her home. He disappears into the marsh. Police can't find him. Helena knows he's coming for her because she's the reason he's spent the last 13 years in prison. So now Helena has to use the hunting and tracking skills that he taught her when she was a little girl to hunt him down before he can come after her family. So those are the two halves of the story. The chapters interlace, and that's the story of the Marsh King's Daughter.
And as you... That does set up quite a bit of tension.
It does.
Both in the characters and in the story. It is incredibly atmospheric and suspenseful. At one point, I actually gasped out loud.
I love hearing that.
Yes, I was like, but I want to unpick, okay, first the character of Helena, because she, okay, if you grow up in isolation, everybody normalizes their childhood.
Exactly.
Especially in isolation. You know, what you're presented with is what you're presented with. And until you know different, you don't. So she reveres her father. He is powerful. He is knowledgeable. He's skilled. He is the god in their household. And she learns everything from him. She learns to disrespect her mother from him. She learns to hunt skin, hares, does, you know, etc., all of marsh life from her father. She does learn how to make jellies and jams from her mother. They have, tell me a bit, because one of the things that was absolutely fascinating about the book is the detail of the marsh and marsh life. So tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me how you knew so much yourself.
All right. During the 1970s, my husband and I moved from the Detroit area in Michigan, so that's absolutely at the southern part of Michigan, 350 miles north to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We had bought 10 acres of wilderness there with the intention of building a little cabin of our own.
From Motor City to the marsh.
Yes, exactly. There was a whole movement in the United States at that time. Many young people, mostly city people, felt a yearning to be closer to nature, and we felt that too. So we had the idea that we would be more self-sufficient. We knew that we couldn't cut ourselves off completely from society because, you know, you still need gasoline for your chainsaw and you have to be able to drive. But we lived in a cabin we lived in a tent while we built our cabin. Our oldest daughter, we moved with her when she was 6 weeks old, which, looking back now, astonishes me.
Insane.
I was. It's no wonder my mother cried when we left, taking her only grandchild. But we had a wonderful time. We carried water from a stream. We sampled wild foods. And because our desire was to live closer to nature, we paid attention to what was going on around us. So, you know, we learned to identify animals by their sounds and plants by where they grew, you know, whether they grew in a wet place or a dry place, what time of year blueberries would ripen. Even we were able to tell time without keeping a clock. We got up when it got light, went to bed when it got dark. But, you know, if we wanted to check and turn on the radio, sure enough, you know, we were able to judge the passage of time. We had firsthand experience with all the biting insects. So all of these things, as I was writing The Marsh King's Daughter, it was just a delight, number one, to revisit those days. Almost like writing a memoir in a sense for me, because all these little details that I had forgotten, I got to revisit. But then also, I consider the book my love letter to the Upper Peninsula. I love the wild places, and so it was a real joy for me to be able to depict it in a way that Helena loves the marsh, and then in turn the reader can enjoy it through her.
And it's so conflicting for Helena, because her father loved the marsh too, and she everything she loves about herself comes from this man, and she is the product of this heinous crime.
Right, and she has, of course, no knowledge of that. The situation and the character of Helena really gave me the opportunity to explore the father-daughter relationship in a stripped-down, almost pure form. As you mentioned earlier, Helena's love for her father is, it goes beyond, I feel, the normal love that a child has for its father, because she has no other adult in her life. There's no grandparent, there's no teacher. She can't even watch television to see how other adults interact. So again, as you were saying, this is her normal. And because her father deliberately cultivated her to be like him, you know, playing into her natural interests, it was a very, very extreme relationship. But I think of it as a very positive one. Helena had a very happy life growing up as far as she's concerned.
And she is, you know, a strong and resourceful bear hunting woman.
Yes, she is.
But the thing is, he tells her stories. He sort of takes on a Native American persona.
Right.
And tells her myths and legends. And the story is also threaded through with Hans Christian Andersen's myth. And myths and legends going back to the Greeks, the rape of the Sabine women. I mean, kidnapping women, kidnapping girls is, you know, as old as prostitution. Boko Haram. I mean, it's, but with, it is in every myth. There's no wonder it continues. You don't necessarily comment on that in that larger aspect, but it obviously came from something.
Right. It's there underlying the book. And Helena's mother in the book is a very tragic figure. She really is. She basically was robbed of everything. You know, she was robbed of her childhood when she was abducted, taken away from everything that she might have enjoyed or known. And then when Helena and her mother leave the marsh, again, I don't think it's giving too much away, things don't go well for them. The adjustment was really difficult for both of them. So
as it would be.
Yes.
As it would be.
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel that was realistic. The novel is Helena's story, and she makes that quite clear even at the end of the opening chapter. She says, I could tell you this and that about my mother. I won't. This isn't her story. It's mine. And I made that deliberate choice, too, as an author, because I did not want to explore what it was like for the mother to be the victim of the kidnapping. I was interested in this child, the daughter. Mm-hmm. And what would it be like to grow up in circumstances that anyone else would say were horrific, but, as we already discussed, was all she ever knew?
Yes, and her mother, in a sense, was even robbed of motherhood.
Yes, that's right.
This is mm-hmm. sort of a final kick in the teeth.
Yes.
After so very many. I wanted to talk about something else interesting about Helena, because it's always the things that we try to avoid, that we go out of our way to avoid, that we always end up recreating, so she is so fearful of losing her husband that she does not tell him her story.
That's right. And so Helena, after she's gone through those teenage adjustment years, which during that period, I think it's interesting, she actually hates her father. So she goes from this pure love to hatred, not only for what he did to her mother, but for all the things about the outside world that he never told her that she should have known. She knows nothing about technology or pop culture or social norms. So every time she turns around, she's making some sort of mistake, and she just quickly realizes that she will never fit in. So when she meets her husband, and he's the first person who is perhaps the only person on the earth who has the gentle temperament, he's a wildlife photographer, to accept her for who she is. And so she feels safe with him, yes, but not safe enough to reveal the truth of her background, because she knows, because of those years that when it didn't go well, so she keeps that hidden. And it's not till later in the book that she realizes she could have trusted him with that information all along.
Well, but and although the book is set in extremis, you know, these are extreme circumstances, it's normal. It's normal, in your teens to reject your parents. It's normal to feel completely like an outsider and that you don't fit in. It's normal to rebel in those circumstances and misbehave. And then it's normal to, when you fall in love, be insecure and think if they really knew me, they wouldn't love me.
That's so true. Very observant, yes. And I think that's one reason why readers are able to respond to Helena's story. None of us have experienced anything like that. But there's a universality to it that readers can relate to.
Yeah. I do need to know, you need to describe the taste and texture of cattail.
Well, it's not as good as Helena thinks.
Again, it's sort of like everyone's mother's cooking.
I like that. Yeah. Well, you boil the cattail heads when they're young and then just scrape them off. And it's kind of a mealy texture. If you had butter and salt and pepper, it's not too bad. It's a bland, it's not a bitter vegetable. Like some wild greens can be quite bitter.
And they actually, heads.
Yes, right. Yeah. And even you can eat young dandelion greens, but you wouldn't want to eat them when they start to get that bitterness. So we didn't necessarily make cattails a regular part of our diet, but we have eaten them.
As a special summer treat.
Yes.
Springtime treat. Cattail jelly.
Yum, yum.
No, not so much. Yes, we do. What I liked about the character of Helena as well is that it is an unsentimental version of back to nature and back to the land, as you were saying. You know, a lot of people really romanticize this, and she has an extremely survivalist, pragmatic approach. She has, a pragmatic approach to hunting. You know, she finds it ridiculous, people having this, aversion to shooting Bambi, but at the same time, like, eating at McDonald's.
That's right. For her, animals are food. And I will add, that's one thing that my husband and I did not do when we were homesteading. We grew vegetables, we foraged, but we did not hunt or fish. So I had to research those scenes to be able to write those scenes and watch some really ugly YouTube videos. But it was unrealistic to expect that Helena and her family would not hunt. And so, as you say, to Helena, an animal isn't a sentimental Bambi. It's food, or it can provide skins to make items out of leather. And I think that's probably consistent, with the Native American way of life before white men came over to the United States. These were your resources that you used to sustain yourself.
So tell me a little bit more about your writing life.
Oh,
and your background as a writer, because I had not heard of you before. I'm sorry, but this book has sort of exploded, and I think will keep reverberating for us. Lee Child for example, is a huge fan of the book. Tell me what your history's been like, and then this explosion.
Yeah, this has been very yes, very different. So I've been around publishing for 18 years, and I got my agent for a first novel that never sold. We worked on together, but basically through that one, I learned how to write. My first published novels came out in mass market paperback in 2008 and 2011, and they were science-based thrillers, similar to what Michael Crichton writes, because... When a person starts writing, they tend to write what they enjoy reading. And I liked those books, so Jurassic Park and Drama Distraint. So that's what I started writing. I had modest success with those. I also organized and ran a writer's organization called Backspace. And as an offshoot of that, I ran conferences in New York for writers, aspiring writers, for 9 years, did 14 events. Towards the tail end, we were also, my business partner and I, were asked to organize and run a week-long retreat for writers on a private island in the Bahamas.
Oh, I assume you turned it down, because who would want to do that?
Exactly. And in fact...
Work.
I know. And Lee was on my faculty a year ago, May, so you know I'm able to claim that I spent a week with Lee Child in the Bahamas.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So the conferences were so successful. There were a number of times when I almost set aside the writing career in favor of the conferences, because they were doing well. But in the lead-up to my 2013 conference... I noted that an author who had gotten her agent at a previous conference was coming out with her second book. And I hadn't written anything. I did. Exactly. That was my wake-up call.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So time's passing.
Am I going to be a writer? And I decided I had not yet reached my publishing goals, even though I'd been busy helping others. And it was very satisfying, or I wouldn't have done it all those years. So, yeah, we decided no more conferences. I concentrated on my writing, got the idea for The Marsh King's Daughter, and the reaction to it has just been astonishing. This is considered psychological suspense, and to me, it's obvious now that this is the kind of book I should have been writing all along. And I know quite a few authors. I could name off 6 or 7 who have done the same thing with their career, had moderate success writing one thing, changed it up, and, you know, became New York Times bestselling authors. So hopefully that's my trajectory on this novel, too. Yeah, it's been pretty astonishing.
Okay, so and where did you get the idea for this?
Oh, well, I was looking for a backstory for a character in another novel. So I was of the mindset that I was looking for a character. Anything I was coming up with just wasn't working. So I woke up in the middle of the night with the first 3 sentences of The Marsh King's Daughter fully formed in my head. I wasn't dreaming about the character. These sentences were just there. And the sentences are, "If I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it right away. My mother was famous, though she never wanted to be. Hers wasn't the kind of fame anyone would wish for. J.C. Dugard, Amanda Berry, Elizabeth Smart, that kind of thing, though my mother was none of them." Again, where does inspiration come from? You know, for a writer or a musician or an artist, the sentences were just there. In the middle of the night, I thought, oh, that's interesting. This character is the daughter of a kidnapped girl and the man who took her. In the morning, it still looked like a good idea, which we know isn't always the case. So I wrote up a few paragraphs in the character's voice, which was essentially her telling me who she is. And that's now the first page of the novel. So it's very
unchanged.
Interesting. Yes,
wow.
Unchanged how it started. And what I also think is interesting is I almost gave the book, in those early paragraphs, an urban setting. Because I was thinking about the women in Cleveland, well, they were girls, really, when they were taken. And they were hidden for so long in plain sight. And that idea intrigued me. You know, obviously, as horrific as it was for them to think of that situation. But at the last minute, I thought, no, maybe that's a little obvious. I'll change it up. So in those that first morning, in those paragraphs, I set the book in a, you know, had Helena grow up in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by marsh. I had not yet found the fairy tale, The Marsh King's Daughter, on which to hang the book. So some people think that the fairy tale inspired the book. It was actually the other way around. I discovered the character through inspiration, set it in the marsh through a quirk of fate or whatever you want to call it. And then I needed a story for the character. That's when I pulled my childhood fairy tale books off the shelf, started paging through them. I was astonished when I found The Marsh King's Daughter because the fit was so perfect. It's the story of the daughter of a beautiful Egyptian princess who is abducted by the evil Marsh King. And obviously that's my character, Helena. I actually name her Helena because in the fairy tale, the daughter's name is Helga. And then, you know, so I wanted a version of that. So I used about a third of this fairy tale to form the backbone or the structure of the book.
And it is interesting because so frequently to that choice that you made to tell her story, because so frequently it is like I'm adopted and it's always somebody else's story.
Interesting.
It's not the child's story. And she's a beautiful character, so thank you for giving us her voice and her story. Some people have described it as room, but outside.
Yes, that's a great way to put it, yeah.
Fantastic. Congratulations. Welcome to the UK. Come back with your third.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here, and it's been delightful talking with you this morning.
Thank you so much.